From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a look at the U.S. war against drug traffickers and their money launderers. In her new book, Desperados, journalist Elaine Shannon analyzes how effective the Reagan administration's anti-drug campaign has really been. Also today, I speak with science writer Dougal Dixon. His lifelong fascination with dinosaurs led him to wonder what they would look like today if they hadn't become extinct. He tries to answer that in his new book, The New Dinosaurs. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new album by a little-known Yugoslavian pianist who Lloyd thinks is on the verge of a breakthrough. And guest critic Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation of the novel Up the Down Staircase. It's 25 years old this year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. A 2-year sting operation run by U.S. Customs ended this week with the indictment of an international bank involved in laundering drug money for the international cocaine cartel based in Medellin, Colombia. Bank officials and drug traffickers were also indicted as a result of this money laundering sting. My guest, Elaine Shannon, has been covering international drug trafficking for the last 10 years for Newsweek and now for Time magazine. Her new book, Desperados, is about the politics of drugs. She's investigated Latin American countries where, in some places, drug lords can buy off officials at every level of government. And Shannon has investigated the U.S. war on drugs. By the time Ronald Reagan took office, she says, an American president dared not acknowledge the extent of the Latin American drug trade or official complicity in it. To do so would risk insulting foreign leaders who were valued allies. Let's get to money laundering first and why it's so essential to international drug traffickers.
When you sell drugs on the street, you get a lot of $5 and $10 bills, and sometimes you get 20s and 100s. That's street-level sales. You can't carry that around. You can't go buy a house with it. It's just too bulky. When you're talking about people who are doing $10 million or $20 million in volume a month, that gets pretty bulky. They need trucks, and so they needed the money converted into small things that they can move around or wire transfers. What they need is cashier's checks so that they can put one in their shoe or put it in their pocket and fly it to Switzerland or France or Vancouver or wherever they want to buy property. Or they need to wire transfer the money to pay their suppliers or to buy property in the Caribbean or whatever they want to do with it.
Why has it been so difficult to stop money laundering?
Well, because the traffickers themselves don't put their money in the bank in their own name so that it can be wire transferred to wherever they want it to go to. There's a whole new business that started in the late 70s of people who specialize in laundering money. So they get the money from the traffickers, and they put the money into various accounts in their names or their runners' names, and there are a lot of there would be 100 accounts in the name of Esther Gonzalez and Maria Fernandez in Miami. You're never going to figure out who those are. And that's it's a whole cottage industry, these money launderers.
Now that there has been a big sting that has busted a major bank that was doing a lot of money laundering, do you think that drug traffickers are going to be more vulnerable?
Oh, there are plenty more banks. So this happened to be a Middle Eastern bank, and they were pretty sloppy in the way they did it. They actually went to the undercover agents, not knowing who they were. The undercover agents were posing as money launderers. The bank officers noticed what they were doing and went to them and said, hey, we realize what you're doing, and we can help you do it better. Now, that's pretty heavy-handed. But there are plenty of banks all over the United States that are being used. There are certain rules that require banks to report deposits of cash over $10,000. So this has given rise to a practice called smurfing, in which a money launderer will go into the bank and buy a cashier's check for $9,000 because that doesn't have to be reported. The bill in Congress lowers the reporting level to $3,000, so that may cut a little bit of it out, but there are plenty of other ways to launder money, buying real estate directly, for instance.
So you don't think that this successful sting is going to have that much of an impact?
I think it will have an impact on the banks. This is the biggest bank that has ever been indicted. It is an international bank. It operates worldwide in something like 50 or 60 countries. Banks do not like to be publicized with this kind of reputation, and I think other banks and brokerages and other financial institutions that are being used are going to be a lot more vigilant.
Time magazine correspondent Elaine Shannon is my guest, and she's the author of the new book, Desperados, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win. Panama is the country that has become most famous for its money laundering operations. How did Panama become a center for money laundering?
Bank secrecy. They have laws which prevent anybody, and particularly the United States agencies, from getting behind the shells that are the bank accounts in Panama and finding out what's in those bank accounts. It's also a very convenient place for drug traffickers because people speak Spanish. So if you're a big drug trafficker, all you have to do is put your money on a Learjet in Miami and fly it to Panama and be assured of complete secrecy. There was one money launderer who would fly every few days in his jet, and he would get the VIP treatment at the airport from the officials there. They would meet him with an armored truck. Everybody knew who he was. He was very famous, and it was just fine by the Panamanian government.
Do you think that there's going to be any change in Panama's money laundering since the indictment of General Noriega?
The change is that the United States is probably going to get less information than it was before. Just before the indictment of Noriega, because of intense pressure from the DEA and the Customs Service, the Panamanian legislature had passed a law giving a little bit of access to certain bank records. And this would have helped the American government get behind all of those shells. But, of course, when the Noriega thing blew up and when he got indicted, the government is hardly willing to cooperate in that sort of enterprise. And so I think we're going to see very little of it. The customs agents who worked on the sting this week in Florida tell me that they were laundering a lot of money through Panama because this is where the traffickers wanted the money to go, but they can't get those records.
The officials can't get the records?
The U.S. officials, the undercover agents who were working on the sting in Florida, Operation Sea Chase, as in $100 bill chase, they laundered money. They know where it went. They know what accounts it went to in Panama because they sent it there as undercover agents, but they can't get the documents in Panama relating to that. Where did it go from there?
A major problem that you've covered for Time magazine and that you also write about in your new book, Desperados, is how certain government officials in Latin America and law enforcement officials have become complicit with the drug warlords. Is this something new?
No, it's not, but it's bigger than anybody imagined it would be 10 years ago. There's so much fabulous wealth throughout the Third World and in the United States that these officials could not possibly live in the style to which they become accustomed if they lived off their government salary of $100 or $200 a month.
So you're saying that the warlords pay them off?
Oh, yes.
The drug warlords?
Absolutely, all over the world.
The drug lords is what I mean.
Well, some of them are warlords. I mean, they have their own private armies, and they're more powerful than the government armies. They've got better arms. They've got better airplanes. They've got better trucks. They're very well-equipped people. Intimidation is a major factor, but in every country where drugs are produced or transshipped, these are very poor countries. Officials are paid very little. Often there is a system that officials buy their jobs for $1 million, and then they pay $100,000 or $200,000 a month to the central government for the privilege of being in that particular job, because usually the very expensive jobs are in major smuggling centers, and then they use their power in that city to extort the traffickers living in that area. The traffickers have to pay, $1,000 a kilo or something like that to operate there. And that's an informal system of paying the government, because the official salary means nothing.
So on the highest government levels, the drug lords can pay off and contribute to the salary of the government leaders. But you describe how this operates even on a small level, that police officials, law enforcement officials are frequently on the take.
Oh, yes. Well, the powerful people in a city, let's say, would be the head of the federal police, the head of the state police, not so much the mayor, maybe. I mean, you could pay the mayor, but the people that you really need to pay, if you are in any city in any of these trafficking centers, you have to pay the police officials, and you have to pay the military commander for that particular zone. Now, this takes place in the Golden Triangle. It takes place in Mexico. It takes place in Colombia, Peru, wherever you're talking about. The system generally works the same way. Some places are worse than others. For instance, in Mexico, mordida is a particularly ingrained form of corruption. I've just recently talked to agents who came back from Colombia who say it's not that bad in Colombia because they pay certain officials, they terrify others, but it's not as all-encompassing a system as the mordida system, or that means the bite or the bribe in Mexico.
Well, in Mexico, this makes it very difficult for American Drug Enforcement Agency officers to operate because they're working with law enforcement officials who are frequently on the take. And you describe how they're also afraid that their sources will be tortured or intimidated if they're discovered.
Yes, and they have been tortured, intimidated, chopped up, killed, had their fingers pulled off, been sawed up, ice picked to death. It's terrible what happens to informants down there.
Has the Drug Enforcement Agency and the State Department been at odds over how to deal with corrupt political leaders who are on the take?
Oh, yes, very much so in the past. The State Department's usual position is that we will deal with this in private. We will be tough in private, but we will not tell the American people about it or the press or the Congress.
For diplomatic reasons.
For diplomatic reasons. We don't want to embarrass these people. It would be counterproductive. All it will do is create a lot of, or worsen anti-Americanism and arouse nationalism. Now,
and it might badly affect our trade. Is that part of it?
Trade, a lot of these countries, particularly Mexico, have huge outstanding loans that they owe to U.S. banks and European banks, and the bankers do not want the economy of these countries undermined by travel advisories, tourist advisories, because they won't get paid back.
So how has this conflict between the Drug Enforcement Agency and other parts of the government, like the State Department, been played out?
There's tremendous tension in many embassies and many areas between people in law enforcement who are very linear people who see a corrupt official or trafficker and they want to do something about it, and with diplomats who say, well, let's talk about it, let's meet, let's have a communique, let's deal with it in some other way. Actually, the interesting thing is, since the murder of Kiki Camarena, who is a DEA agent killed in Mexico in 1985 by traffickers and elements of the police, the State Department has gotten a lot tougher. Ironically, it's been the Justice Department under Ed Meese, which was the agency which was saying, go slow, let's cooperate, let's say nice things, and State Department was getting tougher and tougher.
Now that General Noriega of Panama has been indicted, do you think that this has sent a message from America to other corrupt government leaders in other countries? What do you think that counts for?
Oh, it counts for a little bit, but there's still a tremendous amount of corruption out there, and you don't see crackdowns in all of these countries. You see some activity. Congress has, since the murder of Camarena and since the indictment of Noriega, Congress has become much more vigilant about the issue of corruption and what the United States government knows about that corruption. And there have been a lot of hearings about whether or not the executive branch is covering up for various officials with whom the CIA and the Pentagon and the State Department have cozy relationships for other reasons. So a lot more is coming out about corrupt officials all over the world. The problem with that is that a lot of these officials don't really think about the big picture, and they don't think they're going to get caught. Just a few weeks ago, for instance, a group of DEA agents found out that a plane full of cocaine was flying into an airport in Mexico. They alerted the Mexican Federal Judicial Police, who agreed to send in 25 men, which was good, to go get that airplane. And when the DEA and the MFJP agents arrived at the airport, the plane was being guarded by a whole bunch of Mexican Marines who pulled their guns on the Mexican agents and the DEA agents, and there was a very tense standoff. Finally, the Mexican agents prevailed. They arrested the traffickers, and after about a month, they arrested a few of the Marines, but they didn't immediately arrest the Marines.
I want to get some of your impressions of how the Reagan administration has handled the war on drugs, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Elaine Shannon. She's Washington correspondent for Time magazine. She's reported on the international drug trade for 10 years. Her new book is titled Desperados, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win. She's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Elaine Shannon is my guest, author of the new book Desperados, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win. Let's discuss some of your impressions of how the Reagan administration has handled the war against drugs. You write in your new book that for a politician with a law and order image, President Reagan has been strangely disengaged from the drug problem, and I'd like for you to explain what you mean.
Well, during the first 4 or 5 years of the Reagan administration, the Reagan administration cut the budget for drug education and treatment by 40%. In the first 2 years of Reagan's administration, the Office of Management and Budget under him attempted to cut very sharply the law enforcement budgets for DEA and Customs and the FBI. It was so bad in 1981 that a DEA office in Jacksonville, Florida, held a bake sale so they could get money for gasoline to do night stakeouts. That situation was remedied because the Attorney General at that time, Attorney General William French Smith, went to Reagan himself over David Stockman, the budget director's head, and appealed to him and said, look, this is domestic defense. This is really important. So Reagan agreed. But Reagan just really has never seemed very interested in the topic. He didn't get interested in it until 1986 when his pollster came to him and to Don Regan and said, look, people are really upset about drugs in their communities. This could be a big issue in the fall elections, and we need to get on it. The Democrats were also getting on it because their polls were picking up the same thing. So it was very, very, very much motivated by politics.
Well, that pollster's comments that you just mentioned led to the Just Say No campaign. Do you think that's an effective campaign?
Actually, Nancy Reagan had been doing that a little bit before. She had gotten a very bad image when she first came to Washington for wearing a lot of clothes and the China, buying China for the White House. And the White House needed something serious for her to do, so they made this her cause. I think she's done a lot of good. A lot of people from both parties admire her. I mean, she really means what she says, and I think she pays attention, and I think she has been a lot more dedicated and a lot more committed than, let's say, George Bush.
Well, let's get to George Bush. He's responsible for two different anti-drug projects, the South Florida Drug Task Force and the National Border Interdiction System. You say both of these are not taken seriously by federal law enforcement officials.
That's right.
Would you explain a little bit about what these projects are and why you've observed that they're not taken seriously?
Well, the South Florida Task Force was the first. That came in late 82. That had Bush's name on it. Mostly it was the White House's political response to demands from people in Florida who said, we are being overrun. There were cocaine traffickers moving into South Florida. They were shooting at each other on the street. They were a real menace to public safety. A lot of money was floating around, and people were just raising Cain. And so what happened was the White House ordered the agencies, meaning Customs, DEA, FBI, other agencies, to take agents away from other parts of the country and put them in Florida on temporary duty. That's a good idea. They should have put more people there permanently, and they have, as the budgets have gotten larger, put more people there permanently. But this was a political response. I think that the task force did some good, although I think the agencies with the increased manpower would have done it anyway. They didn't really need Bush's name. Bush attended a few meetings. He held the press conferences. I've talked to people who briefed him before the press conferences, and they were astonished at his lack of knowledge about the specifics. The second thing that Bush is in charge of is something called the National Narcotics Border Interdiction System. It's just a sort of an office and generates some press releases, but all it does is sort of form a liaison with the Defense Department to get certain kinds of radar and other planes, and that could be done and is being done by the liaison offices at DEA and Customs and the other agencies. So it's really mostly a vehicle for issuing press releases with the Vice President's name on it.
In your new book, Desperados, you write that you're skeptical that George Bush didn't know about Noriega's role in drug trafficking until Noriega's indictment. Why are you so skeptical of that?
How could he not? I knew a lot. Every reporter that covers the beat knew a lot. He's probably correct in saying that we didn't have hard evidence until the grand jury process started going. And what I presume he means is we didn't have people coming in and saying, I directly saw Noriega directly take money. Over the years, starting in, 1970 or 71, when Noriega was head of military intelligence for Panama, he would be the equivalent of the head of the CIA, there were allegations about Noriega protecting traffickers. It was so bad in 1972 that the Nixon White House tried to get General Torrijos, who ran Panama then, to fire Noriega. The White House at that time didn't say much about Noriega in public, but they did in private. The Reagan administration has been much different. DEA and Customs were complaining loudly about the growing money laundering system and the growing transshipment system and the growing transit of high technology to Cuba back in 82, 83. If George Bush didn't know, he certainly had access to intelligence reports and other things that I didn't have access to, and I certainly knew about it.
Oliver North figures into your new book, Desperados. The cocaine cartel was setting up a lab in Nicaragua, and as the DEA was moving in on busting this lab, you say that Oliver North leaked the story so that the bust couldn't be carried through. Would you explain?
That's a real scandal. I think he leaked it. Everybody thinks he did. And the reason is this. The DEA got hold of a trafficker called Barry Seal, and he was a very, very good pilot, and he had a bunch of other pilots working for him, and he performed a service for the Medellin cartel, which is a big Colombian cartel. He flew their dope into the country. He had penetrated to the highest levels of the cartel. Well, DEA had never had an informant this good or this high up. It was like having a mole at the top of the Kremlin. Seal flew into Nicaragua and flew some cocaine out, and he had a hidden camera on his airplane, and it took pictures of him landing at a military airstrip in Nicaragua. Well, the pictures were obtained by the White House, I believe, through the CIA, which put the camera on the plane, and the White House gave those pictures out, and suddenly a story appeared in the Washington Times, not only describing the operation that Seal was involved in, but embroidering on it and adding details and saying that Daniel Ortega, the president of Nicaragua, that his brother Humberto Ortega was involved, and other things that Seal didn't know and did not testify to ever and didn't say and didn't see.
So what's the Oliver North connection, as you understand it?
Well, after the pictures were made, DEA wanted to continue the penetration.
In secret?
In secret, yes. And Seal talked of inveigling the heads of the cartel onto his airplane, and instead of flying them to Aruba or Nassau, wherever they wanted to go, he would fly them to Miami. The lab was being built, but it hadn't been completed yet, and DEA wanted to find out where it was, and they wanted to know more about corruption. They said, why not find out exactly what's going on? We need more information. But suddenly this story appeared. It was just very lucky that Seal was not in South America at the time the story appeared, because he would have been killed. He was killed a year later. North knew. He was in meetings. He was briefed on this operation. And when the story appeared, the DEA agent who told North about the operation called him up and cursed him and screamed at him in Brooklynese, and North said, well, I thought it was okay to release it. Well, of course it wasn't. The man's life was in danger. Not only that, North suggested to the agent at one point that Seal take $1.5 million that belonged to the cartel, which Seal was supposed to deliver, and deliver it to the Contras instead.
What do you think was Oliver North's motivation for leaking the story?
To smear the Sandinistas. It was right before a vote on aid to the Contras, and both houses were very angry at the administration. The Senate had just discovered that the administration and CIA had mined the harbors in Nicaragua, and the vote went against the administration. That was when the first major Boland Amendment was passed, preventing armed aid to the Contras. North wanted to turn it around, and he wanted to hurt the Sandinistas.
So he thought that by breaking the story that there might be a Sandinista connection to the drug trafficking, that it would help him in raising money for the Contras.
Absolutely. And it got worse. Ronald Reagan went on television a few months later and used these pictures that Seal took and said the top level of the Nicaraguan government is involved in drug trafficking. And, of course, there was no proof of this.
There was no proof of the Sandinistas' involvement in this?
No. I'm sure that the Sandinistas or some members of the government were corrupted. Seal did land in Nicaragua. He landed in a military field. You can see in the pictures people in uniform unloading a lot of cocaine. But that doesn't mean that the top level of the government was taking the money any more than if you land in Texas and some local policemen come and take cocaine off a plane, which happens, or in Florida or Georgia, that the governor of the state is corrupt. It doesn't follow. You have to have more evidence than they had to say that, and they said it anyway.
Well, I think one of the conclusions that you reach in your new book is that the Reagan administration has been much tougher on drug trafficking when it reflects badly on the communists.
Well, that's the irony, is that at the same time this lab was being built in Nicaragua, the traffickers weren't really staying in Nicaragua. It wasn't their kind of place. They liked more luxury than you can get in Managua. So they were staying in Panama. You didn't see Ronald Reagan going on the air and showing pictures of the hotel they were staying at in Panama. There was no proof at the time that General Noriega knew about their stay in Panama, but fairly recently, Noriega's advisor, Jose Blandon, came to the United States. He more or less defected, and he said that Noriega was shaking the traffickers down to the tune of $1 million a month for them to stay in Panama.
We only have about a minute left, but let me ask you this question. Your book has a very pessimistic subtitle, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win. I mean, do you believe that America cannot win the war against drugs?
We can win it if we stop using drugs, or if we slow down and if we notice one another using drugs and do something about it, if we notice our coworkers using drugs and say, look, you know, you've got to cut that out, if we have some responsibility, some punishment for users, whether it's sort of programs where they have to work on weekends or whatever. These foreign countries are not going to win it for us. We don't have enough bullets to shoot all the traffickers. We don't have enough electric chairs to electrocute them all. We can't expect other countries to do this for us, and that's been our policy for too long. We have to do this ourselves, and I don't know whether we have the will to do that, but we better find it.
Elaine Shannon, thank you very much for talking with us. Elaine Shannon is Washington correspondent for Time magazine. Her new book, Desperados, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win, is published by Viking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Mexican poet and essayist Octavio Paz. His book, The Labyrinth of Solitude, is considered a classic work in Mexican literature. It articulated the character of Mexican culture. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If the dinosaurs hadn't become extinct, what would they look like today? Coming up, science writer Dougal Dixon thinks he has an answer. His new book, The New Dinosaurs, mixes fantasy and science to answer the question he's been stuck on since he was five. Also today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording featuring Yugoslavian pianist Dubravka Tomsic. She's hardly well known, but Lloyd says he has a hunch that that will change in the next year. And guest critic Maureen Carrigan rereads Up the Down Staircase and examines how well the novel's portrayal of teachers holds up 25 years after its publication. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Texas Air Corporation, owners of Eastern Airlines, is selling Eastern's Northeast shuttle route to wealthy developer Donald Trump for $365 million. Texas Air Chairman Frank Lorenzo made the announcement today during a news conference at Trump's Plaza Hotel in New York. Trump was on hand to offer encouraging words about his plans for the profitable shuttle service.
What I want to do is run it as a diamond, an absolute diamond. I want the employees to be well taken care of. I want everybody to be happy. As Frank said, we're keeping the same people right on. We're not letting anyone go. But I want to run it immaculately clean, as we do with this hotel, as we do with whatever we do.
The Eastern Shuttle operates between Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. The sale is expected to be closed by year's end. But Eastern's machinist union has vowed to go to court to block the deal, saying the airline violated federal labor law by failing to negotiate with its unions before reaching an agreement with Trump. Michael Dukakis prepared for tomorrow's debate with George Bush as the Democratic presidential candidate draws closer to Bush in the polls. Dukakis' forces see the debate as his chance to confront Bush on the charges the Republican campaign has been heaping on him. Bush today denied he is running a negative campaign.
What I have to do is make him be what he is, and that he seems reluctant to do, and then I got to be what I am. And that second part is the what I really want to concentrate on at this debate, although he cannot run away from his past, so he can't say today that he's mainstream when he has been on the left-hand spectrum of the American political process.
Bush currently enjoys a projected lead in the Electoral College that exceeds his narrowing margin in national polls. Congress today approved and sent to President Reagan a historic bill which streamlines the process for the Pentagon to close or consolidate unneeded military bases. The Senate tally was 87-7. The House vote was equally overwhelming, 370-31. The measure limits congressional interference in base closing decisions and is expected to save up to $5 billion a year in operating costs. A 12-member commission is already at work on a list of domestic military installations targeted to be shut down. Engineers at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida today finished dismantling the two booster rockets used to launch the space shuttle Discovery. They say they couldn't be happier with what they found. More from NPR's Howard Berkus.
The NASA rocket engineers say the Discovery boosters showed no signs at all of leaking hot gas. They say that means they were successful in their $500 million, two-and-a-half-year effort to redesign the shuttle boosters. The redesign was prompted by the explosion of the shuttle Challenger in 1986. That accident was blamed on a faulty joint in a Challenger booster. The joint failed to keep hot gases from leaking out of the rocket. Engineers from NASA and booster maker Morton Thiokol added O-rings and new seals to the joints. The Discovery mission was the first flight test of these redesigned boosters. Engineers say one more test remains. A ground test is scheduled in December, in which a redesigned booster will be subjected to cold temperatures, like those that contributed to the Challenger accident. Redesigned boosters will be used in the meantime for the next shuttle flight, scheduled for next month. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
A new 20-member government was named today in Czechoslovakia. The appointments announced by President Gustav Husák follows the resignations of the country's prime minister and his cabinet earlier this week. On Wall Street today, stocks were down sharply. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 30 points to close at 2126.24. Declines outnumbered advances by more than 3-1 on volume of 156 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 42 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz wants to introduce us to the work of a pianist he hadn't even heard of until a short time ago. Her name is Dubravka Tomsic, and she lives in Yugoslavia. But Lloyd predicts that by next year, she'll be a lot better known in this country than she is now.
Months ago, my friend George Curran, an adventurous record collector, picked up an extremely low-priced CD on the Stradivari label. It was an album of Bach played on the piano, not so common since the early music movement started insisting that Baroque harpsichord music should be played on the harpsichord. My friend was impressed and called to ask if I knew anything about the pianist, Dubravka Tomsic. I didn't. I called my colleague, the Boston Globe's music critic Richard Dyer, who is especially expert on keyboard artists. He had received several review copies, but he hadn't heard them yet. When he did, he was so impressed that he called Stradivari Records in Hackensack, New Jersey, and the director suggested that he telephone Tomsic herself in Yugoslavia. Tomsic, it turns out, was born in Dubrovnik 48 years ago and had been a child prodigy. At 12, she came to study at Juilliard. At 15, she won a competition and played the Grieg Concerto with the New York Philharmonic. At 17, she made her solo debut at Carnegie Hall. And at 19, she returned to Yugoslavia, where she got married, had a son, and settled down to become a Yugoslavian celebrity. Perhaps the most remarkable part of her story concerns pianist Arthur Rubinstein. When Tomsic ran out of money to continue her studies, Rubinstein himself took up her cause with the Yugoslavian ambassador. As a result, no less a personage than Marshal Tito, president of Yugoslavia, agreed to subsidize Tomsic's musical education with his own money, provided that Rubinstein agree to become her teacher, which he did. Tomsic's recordings are certainly remarkable. Fleet, elegant, extremely lyrical, yet sometimes hair-raising in their manic energy. Tomsic has a glorious singing tone, a little like Rubinstein's, yet with a musical sensitivity that reminds you more of musicians as profound in their different ways as Dino Lupati, Glenn Gould, Artur Schnabel, and especially Harold Samuel, the great Bach pianist of the 1930s. At the moment, there are some 10 compact discs of her recordings available on two labels, Stradivari and the Vienna Master Series on PMG. Several of the pieces are on both labels. They demonstrate a remarkable range. Bach, a Mozart concerto, Scarlatti, Beethoven, 3 sonatas and 2 concertos, Chopin, Tchaikovsky, and the Grieg Concerto. She plays a nearly 9-minute Scarlatti sonata in F minor, whose repeated phrases I find so haunting and mysterious, I can't stop listening to it. Her performance of the Grieg Concerto is one of the best I've ever heard, maybe the best. Her name is missing from the record label and the liner notes, but Stradivari Records promises that this omission will soon be corrected. Besides, anyone who's come to know Dubravka Tomsic's work from her other recordings will soon realize that the fresh, imaginative phrasing and lilting, rippling sweetness of these familiar tunes couldn't be by anyone else.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. By the way, Lloyd says next summer American audiences will have the opportunity to hear Dubravka Tomsic in person. She'll open the Newport Music Festival. This is Fresh Air. Dougal Dixon has been fascinated by dinosaurs since he was five. His interest was so great, he sold his toy train set and bought some modeling clay and a camera to make his own monster movies. Dixon still does some animation on the side, but he's best known for his imaginative science writing. His 1981 book, After Man, predicts how animals and birds might look after another 50 million years of evolution. His new book, The New Dinosaurs, combines science and fantasy to illustrate the dinosaurs that might have been.
The premise is quite simple. It's a speculative piece on if the dinosaurs had not become extinct, what would animal life on the globe be like today?
So you're speculating on what dinosaurs would be like if they weren't made extinct 65 million years ago.
Right. What? Over the last 65 million years, the surface of the globe has changed quite considerably. The movement of the continents and development of new climatic zones, new environments. These were changes that were far greater than the changes that actually took place during the age of dinosaurs itself. And so if the dinosaurs continued until today, they would have had to change at quite a considerable rate just to keep up with the change in the environments. So the dinosaur life that we would have today would be quite different from the dinosaur life we'd know from the fossil record.
So what were your ground rules in creating the new imaginary dinosaurs?
Basically, we had to see what environments would be available to them today, then see what kind of animal is best fitted for each particular environment. A different kind of animal would climb a tree and eat fruit from the animal that would live in open grasslands and eat grass, and so on. So knowing the sort of animal that we would need, I then went back to the age of dinosaurs, looked at the types of dinosaurs that were the most prolific, the most successful at the very end, and suggested that those are the ones that would have continued to evolve, continued to change, to produce the animal life that we see around us today.
Let's look at one of the dinosaurs you've imagined would exist on the North American continent, and this is something called the monocorn. And to me, it looks something like a cross between a dinosaur and a buffalo with some things that would fit in neither category at all.
The monocorn lives on the North American prairies, which are essentially grasslands. Now, grasslands are one of these environments that that are quite new. They only evolved about 50 million years ago, since the time of the dinosaurs. And grasslands are one of the new environments that the dinosaurs would have to adapt to if they were living today. To live in the grasslands, and to eat grass, you need a very sophisticated tooth pattern, because grass is remarkably tough stuff. And you need a very complex stomach system as well. Also, on a grassland, the grasslands tend to be very wide open spaces, and enemies can be seen coming from long distances. So an animal that lives on the on grasslands tend to be a long-legged running animal that can run away swiftly when danger approaches. And if we had dinosaurs today, you would have long-legged running dinosaurs living on the prairies and the savannas and the open grasslands of today.
The dinosaurs in your book are drawn with loving detail. I wonder if you think that these imagined creatures are any more bizarre than the actual real dinosaurs who roamed the Earth over 65 million years ago.
The trouble with straightforward dinosaur paleontology is that we have very, very little in the way of evidence. We have bones, we have skeletons, we have footprints, but a lot of the artwork of ancient dinosaurs that you see today is very largely speculative. And it is very likely that that some of the dinosaurs and some of their habits, their eating habits, their lifestyles, were indeed very, very bizarre, and we just cannot visualize them. We do not have proof, direct proof as to what their detailed lifestyle was like. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me at all if some of the dinosaurs of the past actually did exist in the way that that I have suggested in this book.
You've done a very interesting critique of dinosaur books and dinosaur movies. And I'd like to go over some of the perceptions that you've had about monster movies and dinosaur films. There's a lot of the movies are based on the Lost World theory, that there's a part of the world that was left untouched since millennia ago. What do you find impossible about that?
I don't find the actual concept impossible, but the way that where the concept is presented in movies, in works of fiction, is a little bit unlikely. These areas must be very small areas, otherwise they would have been discovered up until now. So if an expedition went into a lost world now, the leader of the expedition wouldn't say, "Oh, a brontosaurus, oh, an iguanodon, oh, triceratops," because those animals just would not be there. If the dinosaurs had existed and continued to exist in such a small area, they would have developed very small forms in order to make the best use of the limited resources, the limited food supplies in a small area like that.
Do you have favourite monster movies when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, I have favourite monster movies now, for goodness sake. I've never grown up.
What are some of your favourites?
One of my favourite dinosaur movies was The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and that was one of the earliest dinosaur movies of the 1950s. The thing was so successful when it came out that it spawned a whole collection of monster films in that decade. But this was actually the first of them. In it, a dinosaur, one that is totally unknown to science, makes it easier for the designer that way, is thawed out of the Arctic ice pack, and then it's less let loose in New York, and it stamps Manhattan flat. I enjoyed that.
I think it's so funny, the idea of a dinosaur surviving and somehow being at home in the middle of a metropolis like Manhattan.
Again, that is very, very unlikely. If if a dinosaur from the past suddenly appeared today, the last thing it would do is walk into a major city and knock the buildings down. It would want to steer clear of such an alien environment and keep well away from it.
There's a whole genre of monster movie where a dinosaur-like creature is created because some kind of egg was exposed to radiation. Godzilla is a good example of this. What do those movies make you think about?
It is, as you say, one of the plot cliches in a monster film like this, that you get some part of the dinosaur, usually the egg, which has lain dormant for 100 million years and hasn't gone off. And it is usually brought to life by some rather unusual agency, such as a volcanic explosion or a nuclear explosion, something that you don't think of as being a life-giving force under normal circumstances. But when this crops up in a film, in a movie, in a work of fiction, it's not there to be criticised from a scientific point of view. It is usually there just as a plot device, just to get the show on the road.
Is Godzilla an interesting dinosaur?
It's a bit of a hybrid dinosaur. It stands on its hind legs, and it stands very vertically. That is because the man inside it has to stand up and work all the switches, and so it has to be human shaped to start with. Then they've stuck on all sorts of spikes and electronic equipment all over it just to make it look spectacular, and then they let it loose in Tokyo to stamp the buildings flat. Again, it's an interesting thing for a dinosaur to do, but I don't think it would actually do that.
Do you ever have dinosaur dreams, dinosaur nightmares?
The last dinosaur nightmare I had was quite some time ago, and I remember it quite clearly. I was being chased by this most hideous thing, and I was in dire peril of my life and of my very soul, and I was absolutely terrified, but at the same time I was thinking, well, I don't think much of the animation, but the superimposition's pretty good.
So you're working on two levels at the same time there.
Does one dream on two levels like that? It's the first experience I'd had of it.
Dougal Dixon is the author of The New Dinosaurs, published by Salem House. Here's the theme from Godzilla. Fresh air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
It's the last day of the National League playoffs. Do you have any good baseball stories for us?
Yes, we do have a baseball story today, actually. It is not about the National League playoffs or about the World Series. It's about the visit by the team of the Mendeleev Chemical Institute of Moscow. It's the first Soviet baseball team ever to come and play in the U.S. We watched them work out today.
How'd they get their name?
Well, that's, Mendeleev, who composed the periodic table of the elements. It's the institute's named for him, and they're in some way affiliated with it.
Any good campaign stories?
One good one today, and that is that Senator Quayle, a Republican candidate for vice president, has reportedly told his campaign managers, enough of what your advice is, I want to be me.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The novel Up the Down Staircase was published 25 years ago this month. It's about an eager but naive teacher whose first assignment is a tough New York City high school. Our guest critic Maureen Corrigan teaches English at Bryn Mawr and Haverford Colleges. She just reread the novel to see how its depiction of the teaching profession holds up.
When it first appeared in 1964, Up the Down Staircase was an immediate smash. It settled on the bestseller list for over a year, was translated into 16 languages, and was made into a movie starring Sandy Dennis. Belle Kaufman's autobiographical novel about a young teacher's first year in a rough New York City high school is probably the best of its genre. I'm referring to combat pedagogy novels like Blackboard Jungle and To Sir With Love. These books make each day in the classroom sound like a mission behind enemy lines and compare teachers to kamikaze pilots burning themselves out emotionally and financially in the attempt to ignite a love of learning in their students. Like all good war stories, these novels always build to a rousing finish. In spring semester, the once raw recruit, now hardened by battle, stands amidst the rubble of the faculty lounge and decides not to accept that cushy prep school offer, but instead to sign on for yet another tour of duty at Armageddon High. Since Up the Down Staircase is a quarter century old, it promises to be about as relevant to high school teaching today as reruns of Our Miss Brooks. Sections have fossilized. The subject of drug addiction is shelved at a faculty meeting in favor of the more widespread problems of smoking in the lavatories and chalk theft. Kaufman's hokey narrative technique also dates the book. The plot unfolds through a series of doodles, school board circulars, and student essays salvaged from the classroom trash can. But mostly, the good old school days sound awfully like the nightmare present. Teenage pregnancy, colossal dropout rates, suicides, rundown facilities, assaults on teachers, they're all there in Kaufman's novel. And the administrative solutions to the crisis in city schools haven't changed much either. In 1984, for instance, a severe teacher shortage in New York led the Board of Education to drop education course requirements and offer college loan forgiveness programs. Since then, more than 5,000 new teachers have been tossed into the city school system and told, in effect, to sink or swim. Most of them lack experience, just like Kaufman's heroine, Sylvia Barrett, whose only qualifications are her eagerness and her newly minted thesis on Chaucer's Book of the Duchess. Whenever Sylvia complains to her principal about the overcrowded classrooms and lack of textbooks, he tells her, "Let it be a challenge." Besides pointing out that too much has remained the same in public schools during the past 25 years, Up the Down Staircase also unintentionally questions its own faith in the power of books. Sylvia Barrett remains at Calvin Coolidge High because she believes in Matthew Arnold's sentimental fallacy that books will uplift and redeem her students. Writing to a friend about her students, she says, "The important thing is to make them feel King Lear's anguish, to point the way to something that should forever lure them." As Lear might say, "What a howl." Sylvia is naive. A few good teachers and a few good books can't change a rigid structure of social inequality. Even this enormously popular book, Up the Down Staircase, hasn't made any concrete improvements in the public schools. But paradoxically, Sylvia's naivete is what continues to make the book compelling. So while the critic in me cleaves to a pessimism of the intellect when thinking about public education, the teacher in me necessarily shares Sylvia's optimism of the will.
Maureen Corrigan contributes book reviews to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I speak with tenor saxophonist Illinois Jacquette. After playing in bands led by Lionel Hampton, Cab Calloway, and Count Basie, Jacquette now has his own big band, and they have a new record. It's his first American release in close to 20 years. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Etta James, Willie Dixon, and Toots Hibbert of Toots and the Maytals. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Accused, starring Kelly McGillis as a prosecuting attorney and Jodie Foster as a victim of a gang rape. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of Philadelphia's business and cultural district. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.